Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters-Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome, everyone, to the Lift Every Voice Book Club podcast. And this month, we are delighted to be welcoming Dorcas Cheng Tozen. She is an award-winning writer, editor, speaker, communications consultant, and the author of several books, including Start, Love, Repeat. And then this beautiful book that we're talking about today, Social Justice for the Sensitive Soul, How to Change the World in Quiet Ways. Gosh, this so speaks to my heart. Dorcas serves as the editorial director of PACS, a Christian nonprofit dedicated to inspiring and equipping the next generation of BIPOC contemplative activists, and is a high school instructor of social innovation at Valley Christian Schools. So welcome, Dorcas. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
And we're joined, of course, by Claudia Love Meyer, my wonderful ongoing conversation partner in all things book club and life. So, Claudia Love, why don't you get us started?
Sure. So, Dorcas, in your first chapter, you mentioned you went to a week-long service learning trip that, in your words, lit a fire in your belly. So could you tell us where it was and what was so transformative about it?
Yes. So I was a college student at the time. And so our school offered an opportunity during spring break to, instead of, you know, go on vacation, to actually do a service learning trip. And so I went with a group of students to the Tenderloin, which is a neighborhood in the city of San Francisco. And it is a low-income neighborhood, continues to be today. Our area of study was homelessness. And so we had been looking at that for the semester leading up to the trip. And then it was a real deep dive into visiting shelters, talking to organizations that served individuals who did not have housing. And it completely transformed the way I see the world, because I had grown up in a family and a context where the conversations were really about personal responsibility, right? And that most of the ills of the world were due to people making poor choices. And certainly, you know, that contributes to some things, but I had never previously understood that there were actually systems that were oppressing people, that the way our societal structures were set up were not actually giving people the opportunity to get out of hard situations. It was keeping them down. And when I began to understand that, I realized, you know, if these are human run institutions, human created systems, then we as humans can do something about it. We can potentially change it. I mean, it is fundamentally wrong and unfair and unjust, right? That individuals would get stuck, and that systems would keep them in a certain place in society and not allow them to flourish and to seek opportunity and to truly be who they are and love, you know, do what they love to do.
Wow. I had this friend that became unhoused because she worked for a car rental company. She had an accident and she was fired and she lost everything. And it was so hard for her to get back on track. She didn't have like an amazing education, and she stayed unhoused for so long because she just couldn't get quite enough for no lack of trying.
Absolutely.
And it changed also, you know, and I didn't particularly think that people were unhoused because of their own fault, their own issues, always. But wow, did it make me see that some people are trying super hard and they just can't get there. So thank you for that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You write in the book, you have this quote, you say, being a sensitive soul in social justice work requires to a large extent the courage to be countercultural. It requires deep self-awareness of what you can and cannot do. It requires focus and limits. And I love that quote because being as someone who identifies very much with this sensitive soul and also has chronic illness, as does Claudia Love, we both, I think, wrestle with that tension between our capacity and our desire. So, you know, and you describe this tension a few places in the book. So do you have advice for sensitives? I realize this is kind of the whole book, but how sensitives can more rest more easily in the uncomfortable tension between the focus and the limits, between what we can and what we cannot do?
Yeah, well, this has been very much my own journey and what I hope to encourage others in as well who identify as sensitive, which is doing the inner work of recognizing this is who I am and embracing it, that this is just how I'm wired. It's not a deficiency. I think a lot of times the messages we get from society around us, the cultures around us, is that it's not okay to be sensitive, right? That it's some sort of weakness, some sort of shortcoming. But it's becoming clearer and clearer over time as more research is being done on the personality trait of sensitivity, that it's just how we're wired. It's just how you're born. There's nothing wrong with it. It's actually a fairly sizable, you know, percentage of the population. Some say up to 20%, others say even up to 30%. So even though we're in a minority, it's certainly not a small minority. So if you yourself are not highly sensitive, you definitely know someone who is. Mm-hmm. And so to recognize that that's who you are, that that's perfectly fine, and to embrace that, I think is a huge first step. And to appreciate the gifts that you bring, because there are particular strengths and gifts that sensitive people have that we absolutely need as communities. Yeah. And so our ability to connect with people and with nature, our intuitive sense, the way in which we can notice when something is off, or when someone's not being included, or when a voice isn't being heard, the careful contemplative approach we have to most of what we do. These are all incredible gifts that benefit communities and societies as a whole. And so to even as you might be hearing messages from others telling you, you know, you need to get a thicker skin, you need to be less sensitive, you need to be different. But to really be able to hold on to the belief that, no, this is who I am. This is exactly who I'm supposed to be and who the world needs me to be. And I think for each individual person, you know, how you hold on to that may look a little bit different, but I believe for all of us, it probably will involve some kind of a practice or a rhythm of, you know, whether it be journaling or putting messages on the mirror or something that kind of reminds you of, this is who I am. I am wonderful just the way I am. And I think, you know, having a community around you, having trusted friends and loved ones around you who will remind you of that and affirm your gifts as well, that's a real treasure, I think, to keep us going in the long run.
I so appreciate that, because I love that the book starts from the premise that the sensitive soul, you know, has its own gifts, and you do a beautiful, we'll talk in a little while, but you do such a beautiful gift of opening up what those possible gifts might be. And so it's not even something that we have to overcome or to apologize for or any of that, but to acknowledge that we have our own way of doing this and supporting this social justice work. So thank you for that.
Yes, of course.
Those were some great tips too.
Yeah.
You wrote, if significant enough, burnout can be a form of trauma, mm-hmm. which produces actual physiological changes, including a recalibration of the brain's alarm system and an increase in stress hormone activity and alterations in the system that filters relevant information from the irrelevant. You go on to say, to experience burnout is to harm your mind and body in serious ways. How do your readers respond to such a profound revelation?
Well, for those who've been through it, I think they feel it. You know, it's very affirming to have it be put into words of what they have been experiencing in their mind and body of, yes, this is real trauma that I have experienced. It is taking me a long time to come back from it. Some of us may live with that for the rest of our lives. You know, I've been through a series of burnouts, some of them extremely serious. And now, you know, I do think that it's as a result of all of that, that I live with chronic anxiety now. You know, I have to be much more conscientious of my mental health and my limitations. My physical body just, I think, is more likely to get more exhausted more quickly than it did before. And I am also just getting older, so I think that's part of the process. But I think for those who've been through it, like, yes, absolutely, it puts a name to what it is that they've experienced. And for those who haven't, I would like to think that it is a serious enough warning. So I do think that we don't take burnout seriously enough. The word gets thrown around pretty casually in a lot of circles, but the reality is it takes a toll. And I think I wouldn't wish it upon anyone. You know, if you can avoid it and set healthy boundaries and have regular rhythms and practices of rest and recovery from an earlier age or stage in your life, I would highly recommend that, because that is a much better path than the route that too many of us take, which is that we learn the hard way of the very serious consequences of burnout. But I have gotten the sense that for some folks, if they haven't been through it, it's hard. It's hard to like fully wrap your mind around it and have a clear sense of what the cost is. Because when you're in the midst of it, I think especially we're talking about justice work, you can justify almost any cost, right? For the sake of alleviating the suffering of others and wanting to bring justice to the world. And it's a very rational argument in some ways, but at the same time, again, the cost is just so incredibly high. And when we see activists burning out left and right, you know, the typical activist burns out after 3 to 5 years. And not only do they burn out, but they actually leave the work altogether because they do not know how to remain in this space in a healthy way. There's too few people modeling it for them, teaching them how to do it. And so you think about that cost, that all of the energy and the passion and the ideas and the experience that we're losing because people are burning out and not taking care of themselves and we're not taking care of one another. That's actually really heartbreaking to me. And so I would love to see us be able to find a different way of approaching our work and our justice work in particular.
I think one problem is people don't know that it's burnout, you know, because some people think, well, burnout is just I'm tired and stressed. Mm-hmm. They don't know it's this traumatic thing that changes you.
Yes.
And I think that's a big problem. Someone could think, well, I don't want to do this work anymore. You know, the work mm-hmm. is too hard, that they don't realize that they've experienced this profound yeah. trauma.
Yeah.
So thank you for that, Dorcas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to continue that line of thought around boundaries, because I do really appreciate that you explore that, you know, quite a bit. And particularly in the chapter on what, and you ask, you say, what don't we want to do? What will cause you secondary trauma or empathy fatigue? What social issues are too heartbreaking, painful, or triggering for you? And I thought there was so much wisdom here, because you know, we might often think the thing that most breaks our heart is where we most want to go and bring our gifts and our energy in service of helping to alleviate that suffering. But you say that we should actually reconsider that and redirect our energy to help protect ourselves from that kind of wounding. So I'd love to hear you say more about creating these healthy boundaries and in particular that wisdom that you offer.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it is worth paying attention, right, to what breaks our heart, what really kind of hits us in the gut. You know, oftentimes that is very close to where our deepest passions lie, where our deepest loves are. And so certainly it's worth paying attention to that. But I think my greater point is that if something breaks our heart, how we approach it, how we engage with that issue, it's really important to consider that. You know, so I used to assume when I was younger that it meant that I needed to be all in. You know, I needed to be on the front lines. I needed to be with the suffering. I needed to suffer myself. I needed to give everything toward this cause. And what I'm trying to do in this book is to kind of recalibrate our idea, or maybe a better way of putting it is to broaden our idea of what it actually means to engage in social justice, what it can look like to work for the social good, that you don't have to be on the front lines, be confrontational, be in the face of trauma and suffering every single day, that you can engage in it in really meaningful ways, but in ways that maybe allow you to have a little bit more emotional space. And so maybe it means that you give to organizations, you donate to organizations that do that kind of work, or you, you know, you do work around art or academic research that can support that area, but you're not necessarily the one who is coming face to face with that heartbreak, because as sensitive people, it hits us so much harder than your typical non-sensitive person. And so for every, you know, really horrific, heartrending story you hear, just know that's going to take a little piece of your heart. You know, it's going to, it's like it breaks off a piece of your soul. And you can only do that so many times before you have lost yourself in the midst of this work. And again, like talking about burnout, I don't think we ever want anyone to get to that space, right? Like my greatest hope, and what I think is the healthiest approach to activism, is that we find our niche where the work is really meaningful to us, where we're working on something we care deeply about, and at the same time, we love it, you know, where it actually gives us joy, it gives us energy. We feel like we're exactly where we're supposed to be, and that it's not just, you know, suffering upon suffering upon suffering, because that's going to lead us all to a very sad end, you know, that where we're just going to be tired and exhausted and done. And so for us to sustain this, to keep going, right, is to find work that involves not only us giving, but that nurtures us in return.
Yeah, I love that. I think that emphasis on the joy is so important, because I think particularly in church communities, there's a lot of emphasis on this selfless service, mm-hmm. and that love will sustain you, which of course then leads to this very harmful kind of setup where then if you're not sustained, there must be something wrong with how much you're loving or how much you're doing, mm-hmm. as opposed to looking for where the joy might help to refuel me, and that I actually we'll benefit more from the mutuality of that giving and receiving and that work. Yeah.
And not only for ourselves, right? But for the greater community, because then that allows us to continue to engage for years on end and decades, as opposed to just doing it for a couple of years and then needing to stop.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
So suppose we look at the world and it's trash, and we feel like we have to be love smarter. So we sign up for all the things, and we suffer. How do we know that we're not sent we're how do we know we're sensitive? We're highly sensitive people, rather than we have some huge mental illness. So or is our suffering mental illness? That what is burnout versus mental illness, major depressive episode, bipolar depression episode? How do we know?
Yeah, well, there are some links between individuals who are highly sensitive and a greater vulnerability to anxiety and to depression in particular. And it kind of makes sense, right? Anxiety is oftentimes rooted in this kind of hyper awareness of what's going on and looking out for threats, and sensitive individuals are very good at looking all around us, noticing everything that even is a little bit off or doesn't seem quite right. And then we're such deep feelers, right? And we oftentimes sit in those feelings and kind of cycle through them over and over again. And so that can sometimes lead us to depression as well. And we're deep thinkers, deep, contemplatives. And so we may wrestle with an injustice, with a terrible, awful story that we heard of what someone's been through. We empathize so deeply with them, right? We carry whatever they're experiencing it. We may end up feeling it ourselves and taking that on. And so there can be a little bit of a fine line between sensitivity and really, real challenges to our mental health. And I think that for me, the biggest lesson in all of that is that we all, sensitive or not, need mental health support. And I've interviewed a couple of therapists, and their hope is that people would see counseling therapy not only as, I've hit a crisis, I've burned out, I can't function, now I have to go to therapy, but even as preventative work or as kind of maintenance of, we all need some form of support, because the world is messed up. There's a lot going on that's really hard to process and to take in. And so to have companions with you in that, to have, whether they're professionals or mentors or good friends who can walk with you through that and process with you in that, I think that that's invaluable. And I think a lot of it also is just paying attention to the cues of what's going on in my own mind and my own body. Because I think, at least for me, when I was in my 20s, especially, and was very, very focused on the justice work that I was doing, I dismissed every single cue that my body gave me, because I felt like this is insignificant compared to the problems of the world. And also, I was young enough to assume that it was normal for a 22-year-old to be having heart palpitations all the time. Like, I didn't think twice about it. But I think to grow in that awareness of what is sort of a healthy state of being for my body, and what is not, and what are the, because our bodies are incredibly wise, right? And so they're throwing up warning signs all the time if something's not right. And so for us to really pay attention to that and take it seriously and address it when those warning signs start to occur, rather than waiting until we've hit the crisis moment.
And I am so sad that there's still so much stigma around getting therapy and getting mental health support. Right now, I am in a program called Neighborhood Healers, and it's not being a therapist. It's just plugging in Black people in my sphere of influence to mental health resources. So if somebody sits in my office and they're going through a lot, I can just say, hey, have you ever thought about going over here and talking to somebody? And I really appreciate that being a source of support for people. And it's just really a very simple thing. Yeah. And I wish we had more in communities that mental health care is stigmatized.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a simple act, but so powerful and so meaningful, right? Because you may be the first person they've encountered who is able to say, like, this is perfectly fine. You're okay. Like, this is what these resources are for. And that can make all the difference for people.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When you were sharing about being 22 and your body sort of speaking and having a hard time listening, I remembered that when I was 21, that's when I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And I also was starting my year of volunteer work with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And I had moved from New York to California for it. And I didn't have the skills really at that age to understand both what my body was going through as well as what the demands of the job were doing. I was working with emotionally disturbed youth, which if anything that year taught me that I was not called to do that work, which had its own benefit. But I wish I'd had a book like this at the time. And you talk about different kinds of activists, and you have connectors, creatives, record keepers, builders, equippers, researchers. And they were so helpful to have, you know, not even just one or two different kinds, but a whole spectrum of different ways that your gifts might fit in to these possibilities. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about those, you know, just give us a little sample.
Yeah, sure. So as I was saying earlier, my hope is really just to expand the definition of what it means to engage in social justice work. It's not just about protesting or marching or calling your elected representatives or petitioning. And you can do all of those things. Those are, you know, great forms. But if that feels really uncomfortable for you, if that's incredibly stressful for you, or just doesn't feel quite right, like it doesn't fit, there are so many other options. And what I was so encouraged by as I was researching this book was, because I was specifically looking for historical figures who had engaged in activism in what we might think of as unconventional ways, but it's been happening for, you know, decades, centuries. It's not like it's a brand new idea. And there were so many. You know, there's more than 100 different activists that I talk about in the book itself. And there are many more that I came across that wasn't able to include. And so the six categories that I focused on, but there, again, there's many more. This was just giving examples to hopefully begin to spark some ideas in people's imagination of what this could look like. But connectors are people who engage in what is often called relational activism. So it just people who love engaging with other people, having conversations, loving on them, being in their presence, being with them. That is actually incredibly effective. One of my favorite statistics that I came across as I was doing my research is Adam Grant, the organizational psychologist, did a survey of more than 500 studies. So this is a significant number of studies. And each of these studies involved two individuals sitting down and having a face-to-face conversation. And they were two individuals who came from different backgrounds. So either different socioeconomic backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, religion, nationality. They didn't previously know one another. And they had a face-to-face conversation that was just about getting to know one another, just about being curious about each other, asking questions. So no one's trying to debate each other or convince each other of anything, trying to win an argument. And just that one single in-person conversation, so it wasn't over Zoom, but in-person conversation was enough to reduce prejudice and bias 96% of the time, an incredibly high percentage of time, which there's so few other activities we could engage in that has that high of a rate of return. And so to know that even just how you talk to people in the world, how you engage with them, that can even transform people and how they see the world and how they see others. And that can be really, really significant. And then the second is creative. So these are artists of any form, right? Like every social movement that we have seen in history has been bolstered by incredible artists who have been able to encapsulate the hope and the vision of the movement in their artwork, whether it's music or paintings or poetry, storytelling. All of these aspects of art are really, really powerful, and we shouldn't diminish at all the importance of art and justice, because art can reach people and speak to their souls in ways that, you know, somebody giving a lecture or writing a pamphlet can't necessarily do that. So art is really powerful in uniting us, in encouraging us, sustaining us, and even changing people's perspectives. And then the third is record keepers. So this is actually a really fun category to write about, because I didn't know very much about it. So this is librarians, historians, archivists, even, you know, journalists, photojournalists, documentarians. These are individuals who are recording history and keeping those records so that we have them going forward, because we need to understand what happened in the past, what is happening now, in order for us to know what has been unfair, what has been unjust, who has been left out, who has been ignored, who's been marginalized and oppressed, and how can we right that? How can we do things differently moving forward? We need that knowledge in order to learn our lessons moving forward. And so a lot of authoritarian regimes, for example, you'll see that one of the first groups of people that they begin cracking down on are journalists and historians, because there is a real fear of these people and the power they have in collecting this information and making sure that it remains available to the public. And then fourth, I talk about builders. So these are inventors, engineers, product designers, people who are working in the space of technology and creating new ideas and applications, products that can help improve lives around the world. I mean, there's still incredible inequity when we think about access to technology between, you know, countries like the US and other emerging markets around the world. And technology can do a lot in terms of closing that gap. Technology that is appropriate for those cultures and environments, that is affordable, that is really innovative, and meets their needs exactly, you know, where those individuals are. I also talk about equippers. Equippers are teachers, mentors, trainers, right? So in the civil rights movement, there was an entire academy that every civil rights leader you can think of attended and went through, because it's not like just because Dr. King was Dr. King that he automatically knew what it meant to practice nonviolence or to engage in nonviolent resistance. Those are skills. Those are skills that need to be learned. And so there were teachers that were teaching Dr. King, Rosa Parks, and others, how do you do this? And equipping them. And we absolutely continue to need those teachers. It was because Rosa Parks went through an intensive 6-week training through the Highlander Folk Academy that she then was able to launch the Montgomery bus boycott. It was just a few weeks after completing that training that she decided that she wasn't going to give up her seat on the bus. And then finally, I talk about researchers. So these are academics, scholars, people who are similar to record keepers. They are tracking for us what is truly going on. They're helping us to get to the root of, okay, so we can see that there are a lot of challenges in our societies. There's a lot of inequities, but we need the data. We need to understand who is it that's actually being marginalized and to what degree, and how frequently is it happening. And so their role is essential in leading us toward, and what are the actual solutions that we need? How can we address these inequities and injustices? So that's just a sampling of the types of activities, volunteer work that so sensitive souls may find themselves drawn to, may feel like a place where they can do really meaningful work, because all of these contribute in key ways to social movements. They're not fringe activities. They're not unimportant activities. They're absolutely essential, but they are also places where sensitive souls could thrive.
Yeah, I love that. And I just found it very empowering and affirming. And I did get the sense that, you know, you were open to all kinds of other possibilities, but it gave me, I wouldn't have named all those categories, but the way you explained them, I thought, oh, definitely. And I was recently watching, it's a program on Netflix about food and the history of the Black tradition. And they were talking about the people who cooked for the bus boycott and for the frontline workers. And I thought, there's another way like people can bring their gifts. So anyway, I appreciate you really expanding that because I think it gives us such a wide sense of possibility for how we can contribute.
Thanks. Absolutely. Resilience. To most people, well, maybe not most, what do a lot of people think it is? And what is healthy resilience?
Yeah, well, I can tell you what I definitely thought it was, which was I assumed being resilient meant that you could bounce back from anything and that everything just slides off of you like Teflon, that that your feelings don't get hurt, that you don't get bothered, that if you come up against a huge challenge or failure, you just immediately can pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and move on like it was nothing. And I know people like that, and I have aspired to be like them. I admire them so much. And yet every time I have tried to do that, I have utterly failed because it's just not me. I can't do it. I'm a feeler. I'm a thinker. Like, I need to work through things when something really hard has happened. But in my research, I was really encouraged to find that psychologists have a different definition of what resilience is. And so resilience isn't necessarily just about like you can bounce back and nothing bothers you, but resilience is more about being confident and certain of who you are, your identity, and your calling, your purpose in life, and being able to hold on to that, even as the world swirls around you, even as things go wrong, even as you face hardship, but you still are grounded in, this is who I am, this is what I'm called to do. And that is actually what will keep us moving forward through. It doesn't mean that it won't be really hard, that you won't have really emotional days or feel a lot of pain or hurt or, you know, need to go to counseling. You know, all of that is still true. And at the same time, I think when we have a very clear sense of, despite all that, this is still who I am, and this is what I'm meant to do, and this is my place in the world, this is where I need to be, then that kind of clarity helps us to keep looking forward.
I love that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that too. Well, we have time for maybe one more question, and I thought we would maybe end on the necessity of hope, because I thought that was powerful in your closing chapter. And you talk about hope as both a verb and a choice we make. So I really wanted to ask you, since sensitives do tend to be prone to anxiety and depression, which can make it hard to choose hope on some days, what wisdom would you have for those of us who are struggling for hope to be a verb or a choice?
Yeah. Well, I have had many a day of despair. I would imagine many other sensitives have as well. And I think getting back to what we were saying earlier about listening to your body, listening to your mind, I think that's when we are having those days, that's a signal that our body is giving to us of, okay, like it's time to take a little pause and to change things up a little bit, because it's not healthy to stay in this place of despair, right? Despair is it is this black hole that you can just keep going. Like it, I don't feel like I've ever found the bottom of it, right? And so if you sit in it, you'll just keep sinking lower and lower and lower. And so to begin to step out of that, it does require, I think this is where the choice comes in, right? Like even before we necessarily feel the hope, what would it look like for us to act like we have hope? For me, oftentimes that means even just letting myself pause and rest, because there's hope in that, because the hope is, the underlying assumption is that while I'm resting, somebody else is taking up the cause. Like it's the world is not going to fall apart because I need to take a nap or I just need a day off, right? But trusting that there's so many other people around the world now and in the past and in the future who care so deeply about this and are also, you know, putting their best foot forward as much as I am. And so I can let go for a little bit. And so maybe it's rest, maybe it's going outside, reconnecting with nature, with beauty, with art. Those are all experiences that speak to our soul and strengthen us, right? Sort of help rebuild that foundation of what are we grounded in, and what are our greatest hopes. You know, I think the beauty of nature gives us a wonderful picture of what, you know, our beautiful communities could look like. What could our societies and cultures and countries look like? So, or to, you know, listen to music, things that will give us hope when we feel like we don't have enough in it for ourselves, right? Or conversations with other people. I also like to find really hopeful stories, and those are surprisingly hard to find, right? Because our news cycle is all about the, you know, the terrible and the tragic and the painful. And it's important to know about those things going on in the world, but there's also a lot of good happening in the world. And so to open our eyes to that and to purposefully, intentionally seek out those stories, I think makes such a huge difference. And I'll say, you know, also for me, my spirituality, my faith is very much a grounding force for me in believing that, yes, the moral arc of the universe is bending toward justice, you know, and to, again, look for those signs of it. They sometimes are quiet. They might seem a little bit more hidden, but they're absolutely there. And so I think for us to even develop our own eyes for seeing what's going on that gives us hope, and then to refuel ourselves off of that, so that our inner hope can be built up as well.
That's really beautiful. I love the paying attention to our bodies, giving ourselves rest, engaging in practices of joy and pleasure and spiritual connection, having a community to support us. All of those are such rich resources. So thank you so much, Dorcas. Your book it was really beautiful. And I know so many in our community will identify with the sensitive soul. So Social Justice for the Sensitive Soul, How to Change the World in Quiet Ways. Highly recommend it if you want to feel empowered. So thank you.
Thank you both. It's such a pleasure to be here and be with you in conversation.